We're still on this section, 1815 to 1914, and we were concluding with the Christianity of Europe and thinking of Latin Europe as we concluded. At the beginning, you remember, there were no Protestants in Spain and Portugal. There were missionaries from Great Britain and the U.S. who came in, and you did see churches being started and a lot of evangelism being done. In Italy, the Waldenses spread. A few small Protestant groups in Belgium. In France, there was some revival, but still the Protestant work was weak as you came to the end of this period, and of course it still is. Now let's get on especially into the British Isles, because here Christianity, of course, is strong, and it's a very interesting period of time. General conditions, you have Great Britain leading in this industrial revolution, don't you? So this is a time when cities are growing. Big cities are getting bigger. London and Glasgow are just growing and expanding, getting huge. You have new cities forming. As cities are formed, as industry grows, what happens often in the cities? What marks many of these situations? Do you recall? Ever read any of Charles Dickens' writings that cover some of this period? All right, you have poverty and squalor, don't you? Child labor, a lot of these things. You had legislation coming in that took care of this as time went on. But at first here, labor was really being exploited. Poor work conditions, miserable housing. And Dickens was certainly familiar with that. During this period of time, you have democracy being strengthened in Great Britain. There was more power going to the House of Commons. And the House of Lords had its power restricted, especially in 1911. So that here, the elected house increasingly had power in Great Britain. So you have more of a stress on true democracy. You have the Labour Party being formed during this period, and labor is strong, and it's growing in its strength. Lots of unions. This is a period of a lot of immigration, isn't it? Great immigration to North America, to Australia, to New Zealand, to South Africa. There are a lot from Great Britain, and here we're thinking of the whole, Scotland, Great Britain, England itself, Wales, Ireland. And you have, it's interesting in this period, the Christianity of the United States has a very strong impact on Great Britain. We oftentimes think of Great Britain as influencing the colonies, of course, and that was true in the beginning. But now some of the evangelism of the states is going back to Great Britain and having a very real effect, more of an effect on the common people than the liberal thought from Germany was having, although it was filtering in. Charles Finney was one of these who went over. Charles Finney and his dates, 1792 to 1872. And we'll touch on him when we get to America. But he had two preaching missions in Great Britain. And through his books, Finney had quite an influence in Great Britain. Dwight L. Moody had even greater influence. He had a great impact in Great Britain. His dates, 1837 to 1899. If you ever get up in Massachusetts, it'd be interesting for you to visit Northfield, where he was born, and where they have sort of a museum for D.L. Moody. It's kind of sad, very sad, that the school there, school that he started, has become liberal. And the caretaker of the house where he was born was a liberal who scoffed at Christianity. This was kind of sad, but we witnessed to her, we talked to her when we visited, and she was a scoffer. But this is course, Dwight L. Moody was born, and we'll take up a little more of his life. But he and Sankey, Ira Sankey, who was a singer that went with him, made three extended tours to Great Britain. He was there from 1873 to 75, 81 to 84, and 91 and 92. So that Moody did a lot of work in the British Isles, and the Lord used him. Many came to know the Lord. And other American evangelists also went over and toured through the British Isles, but especially Moody had, I suppose, the greatest influence of any. This was the reign of Queen Victoria. 1837 to 1901. And she was genuinely devout, and she had a great influence in the British Isles, very much in favor of Christianity. And of course, left a great impact on the age, so much so it's often called what? The Victorian Age, right. Sometimes that has some bad connotations, but actually, her influence as a whole was certainly to encourage and strengthen Christianity. Now let's think first of all a little bit about the Church of England itself. In British Isles, the established church, the dominant church. In 1815, it was in pretty bad shape, the beginning of this era. There was a lot of corruption among the clergy. It was in some ways sort of like the Roman Catholic Church at the beginning of the Reformation. Not quite as bad, but there was just a lot of dead ritualism. There were a lot of men in the clergy who weren't even living in the areas where they were supposed to be ministering. They were just living off their income from their job, but without even working at it, so that things were in a very low spiritual condition. A lot of dead ritualism. But during this century, the church gets revitalized. There was a reform of its administration. They tried to cut down on the abuses here that were going on among the clergy. And they went in, they began repairing buildings, and just a surge here of interest. In the Church of England, too, there was a strong evangelical minority. Very strong, even as today there is still an evangelical minority. You think of John Stott and East Church of England. He's part of this evangelical minority that exists today. One of the names we think of during this period is Henry Alford. I'll just mention him along with a few others. His dates are 1810 to 1871. As time went on, he became Dean of Canterbury, and he wrote some hymns. He wrote a commentary, Alford's Commentary, which is still in print and is very good. Another name you may run across is Edward Henry Bickersteth. Bickersteth, and he wrote certain hymns. He was a theologian. Some of his works are still in print today. He became the Bishop of Exeter. Edward Henry Bickersteth. I believe we sing one or two of his hymns, as I recall.
The book on the Trinity, isn't
there? Yes, and he has a work on the Trinity. Bickersteth. So he was one of these fundamental conservative evangelical men. Another name we may be familiar with, Frances Ridley Havergal. And she wrote many, many hymns. Her dates are 1836 to 1878. We think of her especially for her hymns, don't we?
What's her last name?
Havergal. H-A-V-E-R-G-A-L. One of her hymns was, "Take my life and let it be consecrated, Lord, to thee." Those are some lovely hymns that we sing. And during this period, you have the Keswick Conferences begun in 1875. And the goal here was, of course, for renewal of spiritual life. The stress often on the higher life concept. And many of them helped through these conferences. So you can see there's a movement here of spiritual life in the Church of England. Some real evangelicals. Now, it's interesting, along with this, you have another movement growing that is very different, all within the Church of England. It's called the Oxford Movement, because it started at Oxford. Sometimes it's called the Anglo-Catholic Movement. And sometimes it's called the Tractarian Movement. And this movement, within the Church of England, began to emphasize its Catholic heritage rather than the Protestant. And they said our roots ought to be really in the Church of Rome, going on back in this direction, rather than toward the Reformation. So that you have this really taking hold, and you have some very able men getting involved in this. A high church stress, going back to stressing, for example, confession, stressing ritual, going more and more toward the Catholic view of the Mass. This whole thing being emphasized. And one man that you may have read some of his things, I'm not sure, but anyway, his name is fairly familiar. John Henry Newman, 1801 to 1890. And he was a very powerful spokesman for this movement, John Henry Newman. He was brought up as an evangelical, but he turned away from this and he moved increasingly in this direction and finally ended up joining the Roman Catholic Church. He left the Church of England. So that he went all the way. Some of them stayed in the Church of England, see, and they just emphasized, well, let's have our ties with the church, with the Roman Catholic Church, and with our heritage there strengthened. And they still remained in the church. But then you did have many that actually left then the Church of England and went all the way and joined the Roman Catholic Church. And through this period of time, especially from 1833 to 1841, these people issued what they called tracts for the times, when they were publicizing these views and emphasizing them. So you see, you have these parallel movements. You have one that's really low church, evangelical. You have the other that is emphasizing more and more the high church concept, ritual, going back to your roots in Roman Catholicism rather than in the Reformation.
And this be the break-off now of Episcopal Church in this country, the high church? Would that have
any roots in that? Well, you have parallel. You have both movements, of course, in England having their influence also in this country on the Episcopal Church here. It's interesting how the Church of England has managed to be tolerant enough and wide enough to have all of these movements under their umbrella. And of course, many times evangelicals have finally broken away, but many have stayed in the church along with these other high church stress. Now let's think of a few. Well, you have a number of evangelical men, but it wasn't, should I say, as perhaps unified as the high church thing. You just had various evangelicals lifting their voice. Bickersteth was an evangelical. You have Henry Alford. And we're going to notice now several outstanding evangelical scholars. You have F.J.A. Hort, H-O-R-T, going to name three of these men here, that you think of their names often together. 1828 to 1892. And then you have Brooke Foss, F-O-S-S, Westcott, W-E-S-T-C-O-T-T, his dates 1825 to 1901. And then you have another man, Joseph Barber Lightfoot, 1828 to 1889. And these three men were all Cambridge graduates, and they all, at one time or another, taught there. They had professorships there. And they were very keen evangelical scholars, and especially involved in textual criticism, and getting back to the text of the New Testament. Westcott and Hort, in particular here, worked together on this and brought out a text which is called the Westcott and Hort text, and was the standard New Testament text during this period of time, used by liberals and conservatives alike. And it became the basis of some of these later translations being used, for example, connection of the English Revision and American Standard and so forth. So these men were real keen evangelicals. Lightfoot also very interested in this study and in writing commentaries. We think more of Lightfoot and some of the commentaries that are still in print. You get his commentary on Galatians and Philippians and Colossians, some of these. And even though he did his work then, they're still excellent commentaries, enough so that they've been deemed worthy of reprinting. So these are men that, when you think of this period of time in the Church of England, you think of them as outstanding scholars, recognized by the whole world as being outstanding in their field. Westcott and Hort, and then Lightfoot, J.B. Lightfoot. Now, there are some liberals, and I want to just touch on some of these rather briefly too, because you have the influence of German thought coming over. For example, there's one man named Driver, S.R. Driver. His dates are 1846 to 1914. He wrote a book, I have it here, called The Introduction to the Literature of the Old Testament by Driver. And this was very much influenced by German higher critical theories and the documentary hypothesis. For example, he says in his book here, as soon as the book is studied, he's talking about Genesis, as soon as the book is studied with sufficient attention, phenomena disclose themselves which show incontrovertibly that it is composed of distinct documents or sources which have been welded together by a later compiler or redactor into a continuous whole. And then he just goes on to bring out the documentary hypothesis. And you find this being carried out in the book. And this book, this Introduction to the Literature of the Old Testament, had a widespread influence in the English-speaking world. For example, this copy I have is a fifth edition, and it came out in 1894. The first one came out in 1891, but this was widely used for many, many years by liberal seminaries. So this had an influence in the English-speaking world, taking the German ideas and really spreading them. So you have liberal ideas as well, you see, coming out of England, along with men like Westcott and Hort and Lightfoot. Now let's notice the Free Church activity. Get away from the Church of England and think of the free churches. And you have great growth, especially in the free churches during this period. Where do you think they would have their greatest appeal? Churches like the Methodists and Baptists and so forth. Which classes do you think they would appeal to the most? Alright, middle or poor, right. The Church of England, the established church, more catered just to the upper class, to those that were wealthy, well-educated. They didn't have the same appeal to the poor, to the working man, to the factory laborer. But during this period of time, you have great growth in these classes going into the free churches, and the Moody revivals helped here. Moody coming over and having these series of meetings, many people came to know the Lord, and they didn't go primarily into the Church of England. They went into these free churches. And the free churches also were given more freedom. Remember why John Bunyan was in prison for those many years?
Didn't have a
license to preach, right? With the Church of England. So that you can see there's been discrimination down through the years against the free church. The Church of England was the established church and it had the privileges. In fact, for many, many years you couldn't hold public office unless you remember. If you remember the free church legally, you couldn't hold public office. But many of these laws were changed and they were liberalized so that the free churches came to have a legal standing and they weren't discriminated against. The largest groups of these free churches were the Congregationalists, and then the Baptists, and the Methodists. And during this period, we'll touch on one very famous preacher, Charles Haddon Spurgeon. His date's 1834 to 1892. And he's the most famous Baptist preacher of the century. At 19, he became the pastor of an old church in London. And he began preaching. And his preaching began to attract crowds. And they didn't have room. In 1861, they built the Metropolitan Tabernacle. 1861, with 5,000 seats. And Spurgeon used to pack it. So he was a very powerful preacher. He was a moderate Calvinist. He wasn't extreme in his Calvinism, and he wasn't Arminian. He would believe in the security of the believer, for example, some of these areas. And yet would emphasize the need for a person to personally accept the Lord Jesus. He was evangelistic, very strongly so. He preached, of course, this was what he was very gifted at doing. He also wrote books. Some of you may have some of his books he's written. He edited a magazine. He started a school for ministers. He started orphanages. Very, very active during his life. Charles Haddon Spurgeon. We think of him as the most famous Baptist of that period of time. Now, the Methodists became larger than the Baptists, really. They were evangelistic, they were missionary-minded, they were moving ahead very aggressively throughout this period. We'll just mention this, and maybe we can touch on it later. Lathrop gives a rather lengthy paragraph to this revival of New Testament principles that started about 1825. And some of the names we think of, you think of John Darby, John Nelson Darby, and George Mueller. You think of Robert Chapman, Anthony Norris Grove. Some of these men who were deeply concerned to return to the simplicity of the New Testament. This movement also arose in other countries, but it was very, very strong in the British Isles, and became strong, and today is perhaps the strongest evangelical movement in the British Isles. So you have these men here having this this desire to get back to the New Testament, not only in the gospel, but in church order and in simplicity. Now, Satan came in, and there did come in divisions and this sort of thing, but basically there was a real moving of the Spirit of God in this direction. I'd like to go into that in a little more detail further. Now, another movement that arises during this period is the Salvation Army. Now, when you think of the Salvation Army, what comes before your mind? What do you think of? Tim?
Get a coat for
$0.50 instead of $5. You're thinking the Salvation Army store. Well, they didn't start that way. But what else do you think of? All right, discipline. It was organized on a military model, wasn't it? Yeah, you think of street preaching sometimes, don't you? Used to think of drums and bugles and tambourines and all this at their street preaching. Well, William Booth was the man who got the vision of this. His date's 1829 to 1912. He was converted at 15, and he became a preacher. Started preaching very soon. For 9 years, he was with the Methodists, and then he became independent. And then in 1864, he started a mission in the slums of London. He was really concerned. Booth had a real concern for the poor, for those that were living in poverty and the conditions there. And he says something needs to be done. They need to be reached spiritually. They need to be helped physically. Let's do what we can to help these poor people, these that are down and out. And so as we think of the Salvation Army, we think of it as having this particular emphasis that it still is very much involved with. So he started that mission in 1864, and then in 1878 they really formed the Salvation Army itself, and it was formed on a military model, and Booth became the first general, and there was very strong authority. They had different ranks, captains and sergeants and so forth, and there was real discipline and authority. It wasn't a democracy at all. They had open-air meetings. This was something that offended a lot of people. Open-air meetings with drums, and their open-air meetings were a little unorthodox, too, in having their band and this kind of thing, and usually taking up a collection. This became increasingly a mark. The movement spread through the British colonies and the United States. Lazaret makes a comparison with the Franciscans as an order. He says here there is very tight organization and real submission. There was this devotion to others, this selfless kind of devotion, this concern to help others, and this marked the Salvation Army. There was this care for the underprivileged, the man at the bottom. He's the one you want to help. And so the Salvation Army became known for this. Now, it's kind of sad that in many areas, many cases, today the social side of it has completely eclipsed the spiritual. And this is very, very tragic. But at least Booth, I think you can say this, he saw that as Christians, there should be a concern for the physical side as well as the spiritual side. As time went on, they didn't keep a right balance. But there was a real concern in this direction. Let's think of a few other movements that start during this period of time. The YMCA, Young Men's Christian Association, was formed in June of 1844 in Great Britain. Formed by a man named George Williams. And he became concerned to see other young men come to know Christ. He said, I just want to see them come to know Christ. And we have kind of an association. And out of this, you have, of course, young men's, the YMCA spreading to other countries. And like the Salvation Army, and more so even, I suppose, it's ended up just emphasizing the social side of the thing. So that the YMCA, in many, many areas today, simply doesn't give any spiritual message really at all. At least in the sense of a really evangelical message. Sunday school spread during this period. Remember, they were just starting at the end of the previous century. And now they spread. Sunday schools increasingly spread. And in Great Britain during this period, the Roman Catholic Church is growing. Growing in numbers. Now, a lot of it, it's interesting, it wasn't done so much by evangelism. But a lot of the growth here was because of a very severe famine in Ireland. You had the potato famine in Ireland, and this meant that many of the Irish were literally starving, and so they began to immigrate. And you had many of them coming over to to England itself, some to Scotland, and wherever they went, they carried with them their church, which was basically what? It was Roman Catholic, wasn't it? So that here you have very devout, strongly Roman Catholic people, and large groups of them coming into these places in England where really they hadn't had much of a Roman Catholic group at all before. And because of this, the Roman Catholic Church grew in numbers and power, and you had a very loyal, devoted group of people bound together by their church and clinging to it very enthusiastically. So the Roman Catholic Church grew mostly in England because of the influx of the Irish. Let's touch on Wales and Scotland. In Wales, you had growth too. You had various revivals. And in Scotland, there was growth. Real evangelical growth. And there was much missionary work. Scotland's not a large country, but there's been a lot of missionary work that has gone out from that little land. And then, of course, the Scottish people immigrated. Many of them immigrated and carrying their faith with them. Most of them being, of course, Presbyterians. One of the leaders, you may run across this name, we'll mention it during this period of time, who was an outstanding leader in the Church of Scotland, was Thomas Chalmers. Chalmers. His dates are 1780 to 1847. And he was one of the great leaders of the church. We'll mention another name. A man who was a great preacher of the period was Horatio Bonar. B-O-N-A-R. And his dates are 1808 to 1889.
He was in the Church of Scotland.
Mm-hmm. He wrote a number of hymns. These are perhaps what you're most familiar with. He wrote the hymn, for example, Go Labor On, Spend and Be Spent. He wrote a number of very fine hymns. Some of them we sing regularly. A great preacher and really loved the Lord. Now, along with the evangelical stream in Scotland during this period, you do have a liberal stream, too, coming in. You have a man, for example, named William Robertson Smith. William Robertson Smith. And his dates are 1846 to 1894. And he came under the influence of these German critical theories. And he became a professor of Old Testament in the Free Church Seminary in Scotland. But he began teaching some of these liberal ideas, and he wrote a number of articles on the Bible, biblical articles, in the Encyclopedia Britannica, which had quite a widespread influence. And in these, he put out these liberal ideas along the same lines as those from Germany, the documentary hypothesis and so forth. Well, a lot of the Scottish people, the conservatives in the church, really got upset, and they tried him for heresy. And so he left the Church of Scotland, he left his position there in the seminary, and he went down to England and went to Cambridge and became a professor there. But William Robertson Smith, having a great influence through his writings, through the Encyclopedia Britannica, and propounding here these liberal views that are undermining the scripture itself. Another man we think of is George Adam Smith. And you may see a book or two of his at times. He has one on Isaiah, commentary on Isaiah, which I have. His dates are 1856 to 1942. And he studied in Germany, German educated. And while there, he picked up some of these higher critical views. Now, I think we have to remember, too, that some of these men, I don't think realized the direction this was going and how far it would go and what was actually happening. Because when you attack the inspiration of Scripture, in time you're not going to have anything left for a foundation for your faith. And when you really begin undermining confidence in it. But you do have George Adam Smith and some of these men that tried to stay in the evangelical camp and yet were strongly influenced by these German theories as well. Now, let's quickly touch on Ireland during the same period of time. And the potato crop blight. They had a blight that hit their potato crop in 1846 and 47. And a terrible famine because potatoes were raised a lot. It was kind of a staple. And with the potato crop gone, it meant famine. And this was compounded by the great increase in population. Let me just give you a couple figures here to show how the Irish were multiplying. 1800, there were 4.5 million Irish. But in 1841, 41 years later, there were 8,175,000. It almost doubles, see? And this, then, the crop failure hitting them, the increase in population and all, it was really devastating. You had a lot of immigration then taking place, and we already touched on this. So that in 1861, the population was down to 5,800,000. See, it decreased from over 8 million to 5,800,000. But those were hard years for the Irish people. And many of them immigrated. Many came over to the United States. Waves of immigration coming, especially into the New England area, to the big cities. And you have waves of immigration going into England itself and some into Scotland, around Glasgow and these large cities. And of course, as we think of Ireland itself, the Roman Catholic Church is strong, isn't it? Very, very strong. Devoutly Roman Catholic. But Protestantism is flourishing, especially in the north of Ireland. And up there you have the Church of Ireland, and you have the Presbyterians, and you have the Methodists. Very strong. In the north of Ireland. So that in Ireland itself, there's a lot of Protestant activity, but mainly in the north. So that pretty well covers the British Isles for this period. And next time we want to get into the United States in particular and see this the growth, the development during this exciting period of time when the nation was growing geographically and population-wise and every way, a century of unprecedented growth really in the United States. And Christianity is growing too. So next time we'll touch on that.